Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. My name is Clayton Gerard. My pronouns are he, him. And today I am here with Dr. Margaret Price, author of Crip Spacetime, Access, Failure, and Accountability in Academic Life. In Crip Spacetime, Margaret Price intervenes in the competitive, productivity-focused realm of academia by sharing the everyday experiences of disabled academics. Drawing on more than 300 interviews and survey responses, Price demonstrates that individual accommodations, the primary way universities address accessibility, actually impede access rather than enhance it. She argues that the pains and injustices encountered by academia's disabled workers result in their living and working in realities different from non-disabled colleagues, a unique experience of space, time, and being that Price theorizes as Crip Spacetime, highlighting the knowledge that disabled academics already possess and how to achieve sustainable forms of access. Price boldly calls for the university to move away from individualized models of accommodation and toward a new system of collective accountability and care. So thank you so much for being here with me today, Dr. Price. To begin the interview, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. I am an associate professor at Ohio State. I'm white, genderqueer, and disabled. My pronouns are she, her, which makes me a little hard to find as a genderqueer. I'm actually 54 years old. And sometimes I wish when I was a baby queer back in the 90s, I had picked more obvious pronouns. But I've been using these for as a queer for 30 years. So now I'm just doing it. I have both physical and mental disabilities. And I also have the interesting experience of often being taken for non-disabled. For example, I typically am walking where I'm going. I often appear to be cognitively operating in the way that people would expect me to operate. And people often can't discern things that are really disabling for me, like exhaustion, confusion, panic attacks, severe joint pain. So this is kind of jumping ahead to the book already. But that's one of the things that got me really interested in the idea that is behind the book, because I am significantly disabled every day, but most people who meet me tend to think that I am, quote unquote, as has been said to me, healthy as a horse. I love teaching, and I live in Columbus, Ohio with my spouse, Jana, and we have three animals, two dogs and one cat.
Awesome. Thank you for that introduction and sharing a little bit about your life. Just to start off, I'm super excited to talk about Crip Spacetime. It was such a fascinating and interesting book to read. So I'm really looking forward to being able to discuss it with you.
Thank you. To
dive right in, can you start by sharing a little bit about how this book came about for you?
I mentioned this in my excited answer to the last question, but I have been living in Crip Spacetime most of my life. My first autoimmune diagnosis came when I was 15 years old, and I was immediately debilitated, and I had no idea what to make of it. So slowly over the years, I had been building this awareness that the experience of disability that a disabled person is having is often radically different from not only from the experience that the people around them are having, but also the experience that they themselves appear to be having. So it's quite common for disabled people and minoritized people in many positions to protect ourselves or to just try to get through the day or to try to, you know, build our jobs, build our families, build our lives by appearing as okay as possible. Part of the reason for that is, you know, you don't want to get into it with every single person you see. Sometimes it's not worth it. Sometimes you'll be harmed. And also, as the brilliant scholar Joe Shu said, sometimes other people don't deserve deep knowledge of your own suffering. And this is these are very well-known theories in minority studies, passing, covering. These are all forms of survival sometimes that have been really well theorized. So I was slowly over the years connecting the notion of what my life was like as a disabled person to other things that I was experiencing and observing. I'm queer, so I was also observing ways that queers sometimes exist in what seem to be different realities from those around them. I taught at a historically Black college for women, Spelman College, for 4 years. I loved that school. I had an incredible experience, but it was a very strong awakening for me as a white person that I was living in an extremely different and highly privileged reality that my students and most of my colleagues were not living in. And I'm a slow writer. So I wrote my first book, Mad at School. It was published in 2011. And after that book came out, I was thinking about what I wanted to do next. At first, I really wanted to study the experience of mental illness and how that constitutes a distinct reality. I joined up with two wonderful rehabilitation psychologists at Temple University, Mark Salzer and Amber O'Shea, and we were later joined by a rhetorician like myself, Stephanie Kirschbaum, and we began the study with a large-scale survey of academics with mental illnesses. And it was fascinating. We learned all kinds of really interesting things. One of the interesting nuggets we learned from the almost 300 respondents was most faculty who responded to this survey, all of whom are disabled, they all identified as having mental health histories. Fewer than half of the respondents knew who they would talk to at their schools if they wanted to ask for accommodations. So first, the survey had asked them, do you have accommodations? And a relatively small number said yes. And that wasn't surprising because mental health accommodations are not as common in colleges and universities. But then the next question, which was, do you know who you would go to if you needed accommodations, was the real surprise to us. Fewer than half of the respondents said, oh, yeah, I know. I know what office or person I would go to. And as we were analyzing those survey results and thinking through it, our research team began to think, you know, it doesn't really make sense to confine this topic to mental health only. In fact, creating divisions between disabilities itself is seeming less and less useful. And it was really Stephanie's idea when we moved on to the interview phase to start interviewing people in academia who had disabilities of all kinds. And so the survey phase was launched. And by the time the study was completed, the total number of people we had surveyed and or interviewed for the study was over 300. And the findings had actually gone in a completely different direction than I originally anticipated.
Nice. I love that. I love hearing about how the books come about and then also how they might have changed or, you know, shifted shape during the whole process. So to get into the first real question, a central part of this book deliberates on what quote unquote access is. You explain, quote, I want to slow down with access itself, to analyze carefully and bit by bit the textures and shapes of access in academe, so that we can better understand how this concept is mobilized to divide academics against one another and against ourselves. End quote. Can you share a little bit about how you are analyzing access, and how might this concept of access be used to harm rather than help people?
Yes, absolutely. This was actually one of the surprising things, one of the things that changed the direction of the study during the interview phase. Our team originally went into the study thinking, we had some established research questions, and they had to do with what you might call observable phenomena. So one of our questions was, what barriers do disabled academics face in the workplace? And then another question was, what supports do disabled academics have in the workplace? But as we got deeper into the interviews, we realized more and more, it's very hard to say what a barrier or a support even is. Like, it's hard to get a handle on what access even is. We were studying academic space specifically, but I've also done work in public spaces, other kinds of institutional spaces, workplaces. And this is really true of how access operates across the board. Access itself is a slippery concept. Now, one reason why it's a slippery concept is, and here I'm going to lay some rhetoric on people. Access is what a rhetorician would call a topos, T-O-P-O-S. And that just loosely translates to a commonplace or a common idea. So a topos is a common idea that people refer to all the time, but they mean different things by it. So in contemporary US life, a common topos is freedom. People refer to freedom a lot, but they usually don't say what they mean by it. They also may have agendas for using the term freedom that are not well articulated. So when someone uses a topos like, this is for the children, or this is about freedom, this is about safety. When someone invokes a topos like that, they're usually trying to get something done, but kind of in a stealthy way. So access functions like that in university. There is literally no one in university space, or at least no one I've ever met, who is against access. Access is just assumed to be a good thing. Like, yay, we have the Office of Access, or we have diversity, inclusion, and access. We want to make things accessible. And you'll often see other topoi, that's the plural, coming along with the term access. Like, we want to be accessible. We want to foster belonging. We want people to feel welcome. These are really common things to say in university space. However, when you get into specific situations where this term is being used, and especially where it's being demonstrated, where someone is saying, I have set up this space and now it's accessible, or I have organized this event and now it's accessible, or I have this whole office for students and it's dedicated to disability access. Once you look really closely at how those operate, you start to realize there is some not great stuff going on in there. Like, people are defining access in ways that are often well-meant, but not only are not working, but sometimes are actually working against the interests of the people who need the access. So this gets to the part of the question about harm. And we can take the example of using individual accommodations as access. So in most academic spaces, and also most workplaces in the US, and many other countries as well, if you are disabled and you want to access something like, let's say you're going to a public lecture or a class, and you want to be able to access what the person is saying, but you're going to need captioning, live captioning, in order to make that happen, in order to understand the person speaking. Typically, a series of steps has to occur. Number one, you have to identify yourself as disabled. Number two, you have to often get certification that you're disabled. You can't just walk into the office and say, hi, I'm disabled, I need a captioner. You have to prove to that office that you're disabled or disabled enough to deserve or warrant this captioner. That's a process that Alan Samuels calls biocertification, by the way, the process of proving that you are what you say you are. And then you have to enter into the system that's saying, when do you need the captioner? How long do you need the captioner? We have a limited number of captioners. Could you perhaps work with auto captioning? If you do have a live captioner and it's an academic event, is that person going to be able to spell the words that are being used? Are they going to be able to adequately get across the ideas? All these things sort of factor into it. However, and this is really, I'm getting to the big finding of the book here. Most people assume that those difficulties are fixable. You know, it appears to be that we have a system that's relatively solid, but it's just got some problems in how it's executed. You know, we need more captioners. We need captioners who do a better job. Maybe we need to make those certification processes less stressful. However, what we found through our research in Crip Space Time and what I explicate in the book is the system itself is set up so that access will always be impossible. So for example, having to predict what kind of access you're gonna need next week, next month, maybe for the rest of the semester, having to make those predictive moves automatically means that the university has created a two-tier system of people who need access. They've created a group of people who are able to make those predictions reliably, and then another group of people who are not. Many people have very unpredictable disabilities. These could range from seizure disorders, migraines, mental illnesses, certain kinds of physical disabilities. Just using a digital prosthetic itself can mean that some days you can walk and some days you can't. So if you force access to hinge on being able to predict your disability, you've already created a two-class system of disabled people. And one class gets the accommodations and the other class does not. The other issue is that by setting up a system of accommodations, if you need captioning, then you get this. If you need a ramp, then you get that. You have already set up the system as a zero-sum game. You have made access into a limited resource, and you have set up a group of people who have to fight each other for those resources. So I have been in many conversations with other disabled people where incredibly painful conversations ensue, where person A might say, well, I really need the interpreter because XYZ. And another person might say, look, I need the captioning too. I just happen to have a different kind of disability than you do. You know, your need is not more urgent than mine, more severe than mine. You are not more deserving. But the system of access with this, you know, you have to predict your needs. They'll be doled out to you one at a time. Automatically makes it into this kind of capitalist system where we're all fighting each other for scarce resources. And that's why it becomes ultimately harmful by design.
Yeah, thank you for speaking to that. I really appreciate how you went through that so thoughtfully here and in the book, because you bring up a lot of nuances and complexities that are difficult to think through, but really important to consider nonetheless. And this is a pretty big question, but throughout the book, unsurprisingly, you're putting forth this concept of Crip space time, and you do so with the entire book. So I know it's a difficult question to ask to answer for a few minutes, but can you tell us a little bit about what Crip space time is?
Absolutely. And actually, I'm glad I accidentally surged ahead at the beginning and already said a little bit about it, because I think set up a bit what Crip space time is. In a nutshell, it's that sense of existing in a different reality, a reality where everyone around you is perceiving things differently than you are. Speaking of my own case, people may not be perceiving me as disabled. Or what happens much more often, they may be perceiving me as disabled, but not very much. Like, I'm basically okay. I'm probably doing fine. Meanwhile, to be perfectly honest, more than half the time in the workplace, I am hanging by a thread physically. Like, I am about to go home from an ordinary workday and sleep for 8 hours. Or I am about to walk into a class and tell my students, hey, y'all, I am cognitively not able to keep up with responses today, so I'm going to need someone to take notes and help me vocalize. You know, it's an incredibly exhausting space to be in day after day. Sometimes it's also pretty embarrassing. And you have to have a lot of deftness and skill to make it seem okay enough to remain employed, for example, or to remain a student in school. Now, there's a couple of things that crip space time is not. One thing that it's not is simply having a different perspective. And this is a question I get fairly often when I speak on the book. And it's a really legitimate question. It's, well, doesn't that just mean a disabled person has a different perspective than the people around them? Like, we all have different experiences. We all have different perspectives. And as that actually very useful saying goes, you never know what other people are going through. And that's all absolutely true. However, I became aware that we need the concept of crip space-time and other theories of the space-times of minoritized positions because there's a fundamental thing that sets you apart when you're in this kind of space-time, which is that it is impossible to explain what you're going through. There is a communication, a comprehension gap, which is often just insurmountable. And this gets a little bit complicated because I'm not describing something that's monolithically true. Sometimes it is possible to explain what it's like to be in this kind of reality. And many of us who live in crip space-time have friends, allies, fellow minoritized people, fellow disabled people who join us in that space-time all the time. They get it. They either are going through it themselves or they've been around us enough so that they're like, yep, I have a really visceral sense of what this is. And to some degree, what I'm describing, what this overlaps with, is a concept from Mia Mingus called access intimacy. The experience of having someone become close enough to your experience so that they can join you in that space-time. They are fully perceiving the experience and the implications of that reality. And an interesting thing about Mingus's theory is she points out sometimes that's because someone has been your friend for 20 years. And sometimes it's just because they happen to get it. You know, there's not really any way to predict when access intimacy is going to come along. Now, it took me a very long time to articulate that experience of an uncommunicatable difference in reality. And one of the ways I expressed it in the book is, even when we are sitting side by side, we are not inhabiting the same space-time. Two people sitting together in a class or a lecture hall are often having radically different experiences. And again, the key to space-time is not just that they're having different experiences, it's that there is a gap that prevents us from understanding each other's realities. And that's partly why I invoke actual physics when talking about space-time. Not very much. I don't know that much about physics. But one of the interesting things about both special and general relativity is that you can't communicate between the states. So for example, in Einstein's famous example, if one twin gets in the spaceship and leaves at the speed of light, and then the other one comes back and comes back, and now that twin is a different age than their other twin, they're not able to communicate with each other while that's happening. So the radical separation of space times is part of what I was trying to communicate. I also want to say that it's kind of an imperfect theory. I think there are all kinds of ways that you could poke holes in it or say, well, it doesn't really hold true in this way or that way. Or, what about this kind of minoritized experience, or what about multiply minoritized experiences? So I don't mean it to be an airtight theory or metaphor that works for seamlessly for every situation. My idea is more that it be suggestive. Have you been in that experience of a radically different reality that you couldn't communicate from, almost like you were in a glass box? Does that ring a bell with you at all? If so, you might be able to start thinking about your own versions of space-time or crypt space-time.
Yeah, thank you. I love that. And just as you mentioned, how difficult it can be to articulate or express the different space-time or reality that you're experiencing. I've really appreciated reading the book and just like learning more about that, because like you said, it's more than just different perspectives, but it can be hard to kind of capture that when you're trying to tell other people or express it or even make sense of it yourself. So I just think that this is a really generative theory to be using in this context. So thank you for that.
There was actually, if I could just quickly, are we still on the same question? Because I thought of something to add.
Sure.
One thing that helped me recognize this kind of space-time is when people are experiencing lack of understanding between different space-times. So the book opens with an anecdote about a disabled person who's trying to find a location for a meeting that they have. And the elevator's not working, and they go ask someone to help them key card the elevator. But then when they go up in the elevator, they're in a limited space, and the doors are locked, and they have to ask for special permission because they're on a different path than everyone else. And they end up being late to the meeting, and it looks bad, and they're almost crying by the time they get there. That to me was one of the things that alerted me to these different and almost unexplainable realities. When one is experiencing the stress of a minoritized space-time, of crypt space-time, your reactions may seem really weird to the people around you. Like suddenly you're enraged, or suddenly you're crying. Or somebody says, why don't you follow up on that? Why don't you report that incident? And your response, or actually, this is a story from my experience, so I should say my response is, I do not have the energy for that. I am not going to report this. These kinds of reactions may be baffling to the people around us. Like, oh my God, you went from 0 to 60 on the radio meter in like 5 seconds. But what's not being perceived by the other person is, this may be the 10th time today you ran into that particular barrier, or you had this particular conversation, or you were humiliated in this particular way. And so it can be very hard to explain that too, the affective response that is brought about by living in a different and often harder or more oppressive reality.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that sets us up for a lot of the really interesting parts of the book that we can discuss here. One of the things that you teased up was how you drew from other disciplines or fields of knowledge when you're writing this book and thinking through crypt space-time. Can you tell us about some of those influences outside of disability studies that helped you think through what crypt space-time is?
Yeah, absolutely. And two of the really important theoretical frames that were important for me were Indigenous studies and Black feminist studies. And I was hesitant to name these and place these as central influences on me because I am a white scholar and I want to be very cautious about using theories, drawing upon theories that are about Indigenous people or Black feminist theories and Black people in service of a work that's in disability studies, a predominantly white and often quite racist discipline. So I really gave a lot of thought to that. And ultimately, I came to see these influences as conversations. They all started as conversations. So for example, in terms of the Indigenous studies influence, I became aware of the ways that space-time is understood and theorized in Indigenous studies and Indigenous communities from people I was working with directly. So, for example, my friend and colleague, Andrea Riley Muckovitz, a cultural studies scholar and now a coordinator of community engagement for the city of Grand Rapids, told me about theories of space-time as they are understood in Anishinaabeg communities. And I saw her present on this, and we were already friends, and I followed up and asked her about it. And one of the things I learned from Andrea's presentation was in the specific communities that she's a part of in what is now called Michigan, it doesn't make that much sense to say something was here before or something will be here after. That's not how time was working in the Anishinaabeg time as she was explaining it and storying it. So Andrea's specific project is about roads in Michigan. There's a white-centric kind of piece of lore where people like to say, white people like to say, oh, the highways in Michigan all follow Native American pathways, you know, and this assertion may be meant as a claim to history. It may be meant as a claim of some sort of connection to the people that were violently forced off the land. You know, there might be various motivations for telling this story. The Michigan highways used to be Native American pathways. And one of Andrea's projects was to think through that and to ask, well, when someone says that pathways were XYZ before, but they're highways now, you're using a white-centric notion of time, which says there was a before and an after. Part of her project points out the pathways are still there. They didn't go anywhere. But a white-centric understanding of time would say they are now gone because they are the before, and the highways are now here because they are the after or the now. So that's just one small example of many ways that theories of Indigenous space-time, Black feminist space-time, there's a brilliant book by Michelle Alexander on physics and Black studies. I was learning more and more from these. And again, important to me, having conversations with colleagues and friends about ways that these constructs make sense in terms of what I was calling Crip space-time. So I became very influenced by these kinds of theories, by theories of pluriversal. Sorry, I said that sort of muddled. Pluriversal politics. I ultimately ended up dedicating a portion of the introduction of the book to saying, here are some of the ideas of space-time, of belonging, of being, that helped me come to what I now understand as Crip space-time. But it's very important to me to say, I didn't build on anyone else's theory. I didn't, you know, I try not to say that I'm quote unquote using other people's theories. What I say in the book instead is invoking these theories is an attempt to listen and learn. Sometimes I am positive I am not successful. I am as likely to be appropriative using things extractively as the next scholar, especially the next white scholar. But it was incredibly important to me to be engaged in these conversations about space-time in particular and minoritized experience as it relates to space-time. In a lot of ways, I was just joining conversations that were already well established in stories that had been told in many, many other communities. So Crip space-time, to a large degree, is not an original idea at all. It's just lifting up the ideas that I had come to through conversations with friends and colleagues to say, I am recognizing this in my own experience as well.
Yeah, thank you for speaking to that. And I also just want to say I appreciate the ways in which you talk about accountability in the book, and like even how you yourself are accountable to these certain methodologies or epistemologies and theories. So thank you for speaking to those various influences as you were writing in these scholarly conversations.
I should add too, since I mentioned the introduction, Duke University Press has just made it available on their website. So people can read the introduction now if they like to. The whole book will be open source. I was very fortunate to get a grant from the Ohio State University Libraries and the Toward an Open Monograph Ecosystem Project to make the book open source. But the introduction is available right now, like as of today, the day we're recording. So that's very exciting.
Awesome. Yeah. And I'd love to include the link to the open source whenever that's available in the show notes for the podcast so that
Absolutely.
People listening can get access to the full book and its glory and entirety. So to move into some of the specific conversations of your chapters, the following chapters after the introduction cover four dimensions of space-time, which you distinguish as space, time, cost, and accompaniment. So I'd love to dive deeper into some of these different dimensions. And we talked quite a bit about space, but I'd love to go into your chapter on time, specifically where you talk about accommodations loop. And that's a, as you say, familiar experience for quite a few disabled academics trying to go through accommodations and various access needs. But it's a very distinct experience and something that I haven't read too much about, especially in the context of academia. So would you mind telling us a little bit about what the accommodations loop is and why it's such a distinguishing feature in the experiences of disabled academics who participated in your research?
Yes, this one was took a really long time to figure out, but it also was one of the first places I went when I was trying to figure out what Crip spacetime was. The accommodations loop visually looks like a figure eight turned on its side, or an infinity symbol. And there are various kind of recognizable stops along the way. For example, one of the recognizable points along the accommodations figure eight is a faculty member identifies an urgent access need, like something that's happening right now. It's kind of an emergency. Then another recognizable stop on this continually moving figure eight is that the university system is slow to respond. Putting an accommodation in place takes time, almost always. It's incredibly unusual that someone can respond immediately to an immediate access need because of the nature of the structure. So another recognizable stop along the way is the faculty member figures out some way to handle it. It's not an accommodation need that can wait. So the faculty member might self-accommodate, for example, pay for their own accommodation. Or another predictable move that I learned about from interviewees was they would simply drop whatever that activity was. And this could often be professionally very costly, like, okay, well, I guess I won't be at this conference, or I guess I won't get to teach that class. Or I won't be able to meet that fellowship deadline. A couple of other predictable stops along the, again, constantly moving accommodation loop, it has no real beginning and no end, is the faculty member is undergoing, or I'm saying faculty member, but like anybody in this institutional academic space, this person is experiencing increasing pressure as they're trying to figure out, can I self-accommodate this? Do I have to drop this opportunity? Is there going to be some kind of professional crisis or disaster? So the emotional impact of this journey that we're making around the loop is intensifying and intensifying. And then there are a couple of other recognizable, you know, frequently reported stops along the loop, one of which is it is figured out somehow at the cost of perhaps the academic's personal funds or their personal resources. Numerous people that were interviewed spoke of getting spouses or friends to jump in to serve as ad hoc assistants, for example. It is solved somehow. Or again, as I mentioned, the opportunity is just dropped. And then a curious thing happens. Once that singular situation is resolved, often at great cost to the disabled person, it disappears from the university's point of view because the accommodation is no longer needed. And so the disabled person continues traveling around this loop, but from the point of view of the university or the college or the office that's supposed to be granting accommodations or whatever, there is literally no longer a problem. So the accommodation, one of the ways that I set up the accommodations loop as a figure eight, the one half of the loop where the faculty member or the academic is self-accommodating or experiencing emotional harm, is actually not visible from the other side of the loop. That crux in the middle kind of hides all that activity and all that pain and all that effort. And then there's one other little thing in the accommodations loop, which is a break. There's a physical and visual break, which is where the academic simply leaves. Numerous people who were interviewed quit, left, went to other industries. Some of them were forced out of their jobs. One person was forced into unwanted retirement. She's now living in poverty. A couple of people quit tenured positions, which is very unusual in academe. So the gap in the accommodations loop represents sometimes the person traversing the loop just gives up, just leaves.
Yeah, thank you for speaking to that. That's such a crucial experience. And to kind of go along with that, your next chapter is on cost and how that's related to crip space time. This isn't a surprising problem that comes up because, this is very obvious in the book as you talk about, but there's very different costs. And you alluded to some of these earlier of like emotional costs, financial costs, the cost of spending time, or even the concept of disability admin that you talk about in the chapter. So would you mind talking a little bit about how cost is involved in this experience of crip space time? And how does looking at these various ways in which cost is a feature of experience reveal how academe and our society more generally is designed to fail us when it comes to accommodations and access and those sorts of things?
This was a really sad chapter to write, the chapter on cost. And I was also very angry when I wrote it. Some of the book is a little snarky because institutionally speaking, many of these systems, as you say, you know, they are designed to fail us. They are also designed to hurt us. So in certain cost-driven industries, such as medical insurance, there is established terminology for the practice of inconveniencing customers to drive up revenues. One of these terms is slow rolling. And we've all had that experience, or many of us who are privileged enough to have medical insurance have had that experience of you get charged for something and you have to put in a claim to get your money back because you shouldn't have been charged, or you inquire about something and the chatbot that's supposed to talk to you is mysteriously unhelpful, or you're trying to get a live person to talk to, but it takes literally hours to get a live person on the phone. And then they promise to follow up with you, but they never do. These things are not happenstance. There is actually a lot of work in technical communication, in the sociology of employment, in business administration studies, showing that these are established strategies for decreasing the cost to the company or the institution and placing that cost back on the consumer, the person who is trying to access the service. And in this example, literally just trying to access medical care. So it's basically a predictive system. If you inconvenience 100 people, only 90 of them will follow up. So you've made your money off those 10 people. So it's good business. Now, unfortunately, the accommodation system in academia works along similar logic. I don't think it was designed with evil ends in mind. Honestly, I think medical insurance kind of was, but that's another story. Most people working for accommodation and access in higher education are trying to do good. They are trying to help people. However, the system itself is structured such that it can only lead to harm in some cases, and arguably most cases. I don't have the numbers on that. One of the logics of managed care and of accommodation is that instead of thinking about access holistically, you think about access in terms of human units. X number of people are going to need access. And so we are going to divide up the types of people who need accommodations into groups. And we are going to deliver access through units. And that is the most efficient way to do it. In a nonprofit university, at least when you're talking about an office of disability services, typically the idea is not to drive up revenues. It's just to drive down costs. But the outcome is that people are categorized in such a way that access has to rely on the metrics we were talking about earlier, which is they have to be predictable. You have to be in a group of people who can be classified as needing the same thing, the same type of accommodation. You can't have a spontaneous or idiosyncratic access need, for example. Because of the way the Americans with Disabilities Act is written, institutions almost always have an automatic out, which is that the access need cannot place an undue burden on the institution. Or another way that a similar idea is phrased is a disabled worker must still be able to perform the essential functions of their job. So I am personally not against policy in general. I'm not someone who thinks we should do away with all guidelines for access, but my point about cost is basically people are considered by the institution as units, and the end goal of access in university life is always driven by reducing costs. And therefore, we do see the same kinds of strategies that we see in for-profit industries like insurance, the pharmaceutical industry, just any large customer service industry. We see strategies like slow rolling, intimidation, ignoring. Sarah Ahmed calls the strategy of ignoring someone just blanking. You know, someone makes a complaint or requests something and they just receive no response. These are predictable moves that are used across institutions to either drive up their own revenues, drive down their costs, and as the chapter talks about at great length, these strategies have tremendous, sometimes even fatal, and I'm not exaggerating, literally fatal emotional and physical costs for the people who are caught in those systems.
Yeah, thank you for speaking to that. It's such an important piece of many disabled people's experiences. Going into the last chapter, you talk about the dimension of crip space time you call accompaniment. Would you be able to speak to some of the various meanings accompaniment can make in various contexts between people's body minds and technologies like assistive technologies, and then also environments? How does the concept of crypt space-time show how accompaniment and its varied meanings can be helpful for people and also at times hurtful?
I think this was my favorite chapter to write. And I keep saying it took me a long time to figure this out. Like, the book as a whole took 14 years to complete. It was a much, much slower project than I anticipated. But that's partly because I was just figuring so many exciting things out as I went along and learning so many things, both from the participants in the study and from others that I was working with. So the accompaniment chapter, as you mentioned, puts forth this idea of accompaniment, and accompaniment can occur between people. It can occur between people and objects. It can occur between environments, people, objects, non-human animals, and it can also involve technologies. These are all entities that we could think of as accompanying each other. And to some degree, this theory is getting deeper into other theories of what it means to be, that is, ontological theories. For example, theory, as I mentioned, theories of pluriverses, and also theories of intra-action. From Michelle Barad, all of which are, to some degree, are just aimed at saying, this is how I think things are. This is how I think things exist. And accompaniment came to me very slowly because I was noticing how important relations were in crypt space-time. And at first I was noticing relations between people. For example, a disabled person and an interpreter they were working with, or a disabled person, one blind participant told the story of bringing her spouse to academic conferences because not only could she not get the accommodation of someone to assist her at conferences, she didn't particularly want a hired assistant at conferences. As she said, I didn't want people to look at me and say, oh, she has a little helper. So one of her, this goes back to the question of emotional cost. So one of her solutions for access at conferences was simply to bring her husband along. And he would do things like say, oh, I see so-and-so across the room. Or he would walk into a conversation with his spouse, the professor, and then they would both be able to join that conversation together. So I was noticing relations between people, and I began to expand my idea of what relations could mean. And again, here I was strongly learning from Indigenous theories, Black feminist theories, theories of material rhetoric, all of which center relations in really important ways. And I was noticing people are forming relations through environments, through objects, through animals, sometimes service animals, but often other animals would sort of come into play in important ways. So I started thinking of it all together as a kind of matrix. Again, not unlike Michelle Barad's idea of intra-activity, which suggests that when things unfold, when things happen, it's because of a kind of becoming of all these entities together. But I was also noticing, and this is an area where I depart from Barad somewhat, I was noticing not only is reality kind of rendered through these intra-actions, but also there are harms occurring. In fact, sometimes it almost seems as though the events unfolding are unfolding through and because of harm. So as one example, one of the interviewees, whose pseudonym is Nicola, talked about using an object in her classroom as an adaptive device. Nicola sometimes loses balance unpredictably or drops something. She told a story about using the chalk tray in her classroom. Her classroom had chalkboards as a steadying device. So if she knew that she was going to lose her balance while she was writing on the board, she would simply turn around, put her hands on the chalk tray, and use it the way someone might use a walker or some other prop to keep from falling. And part of the story that was important for her was to say, my students did not know I was doing that. Nicola was in a number of subject positions that made her very vulnerable as a non-tenure track instructor. And by choice, she didn't say to her students, for example, I'm about to fall, or I'm really sick today, or any of the things that a more privileged academic like me with tenure might, not definitely would, but might feel freer to say. So what was fascinating to me about this chalkboard tray is that it's an object. It's a material object. It's also not considered an adaptive object. You know, it's not a crutch. It's not a walker. It's not something that is purpose designed to hold up a human body. And it had this kind of transient identity as part of Nicola's crypt space-time, and then it kind of just faded out of that space-time. And that was what really fascinated me about accompaniment, was the constantly shifting nature of these relations and the fact that so often harm or the potential for harm seemed to be a critical part of the way those relations were forming.
Awesome. Yeah, that's such a fascinating way to think about it, and also a very like generative way to see some of the complexities around these experiences.
A lot of people have written really beautifully about objects like prosthetics. Catherine Ott, OTT, for example, is one person who comes to mind. The cyborg Jillian Vaisa, now Cy Vaisa, has written beautifully about prosthetics and their kind of shape-shifting nature in relations of accompaniment. But another thing that feels important to add is very often the relations of accompaniment get glamorized in really simplistic ways. So one of the favorite accompaniment relations that you'll see in popular TV is a deaf person accompanied by an interpreter. And typically in a popular TV show like The L Word, I watched the original L Word when it first came out. Typically, this representation will be completely unrealistic and extremely idealized. Like it will sort of do away with all the potential harms of the accompaniment relation. So the deaf person in The L Word, played beautifully by Marley Matlin, happened to have a dedicated interpreter who was with her all the time. There was no indication of who paid for this. There was no indication of how they formed that relation. There was no indication that he was ever having difficulty vocalizing for the other character. I forget her name in the show, but I'll say it's Marley Matlin. You never saw Marley Matlin cueing him or feeding him signs like, that's not what I was expressing. I was expressing this instead. And also his signing was so minimal, just like a few flips of the hands, and apparently he could get across a whole complex paragraph. So all the things that are potentially complex, expensive, harmful, or inconvenient about the deaf person interpreter relationship were just floated away. Teresa Blankmeyer Burke is one of the people who's written really beautifully about this in her article Choosing Accommodations, as well as other things she's written. For example, Burke points out, what if you do have a really reliable dedicated interpreter? That's great. But then you have someone who's there for your divorce proceedings and your doctor appointments and they're in every conversation with your professional colleagues. Maybe they're kind of making friends with some of your professional colleagues. Like, this is a vulnerable situation to be in. This is not just like an unadulterated joy. And those kinds of complexity are so important to recognize in the accompaniment relation. It's not just that you strap a prosthetic on and suddenly you're flying around the track. Prosthetics physically hurt flesh. Interpreters can make deaf people vulnerable. These are aspects of the accompaniment relation that I think are incredibly important to think through because they're part of that larger picture of crip space time.
Yeah, I love you speaking to that. And it kind of makes me think full circle back to where we begin, that this isn't just a different perspective that people have. It's, you know, a different reality. And crip space time is such an important thing to consider in that regard. So as this conversation's coming to a close, I mean, we've barely scratch the surface really of the book. So I would definitely encourage listeners to go in and dive into the book and all the greatness that it is. But is there anything that we haven't talked about you'd like to speak to? Or are there any books you'd recommend people to read if they're further interested in this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually want to say something here about disability justice. Disability justice is not one of the constructs that I claim to be using in crip space time, for the simple reason that it's an academic book. I don't think that works that are primarily academic and primarily intended to benefit academics should claim to be part of the disability justice movement, except with really, you know, a lot of care and a lot of thought. In my particular case, I did not think that crip space time was a work of disability justice. I do think that it's in alliance with disability justice. I hope that it learns from disability justice in productive ways. But I have a real issue with academic projects designed to benefit primarily academics saying, oh, I'm doing disability justice. So with that said, I'm going to recommend some works of disability justice that I absolutely think people should read and take note of. Two of these works are by Leah Lakshmi Pyepsna Samara Sinha. Her book from a couple of years ago, Care Work, and then her new book, The Future is Disabled. These are just brilliant collections of essays. Some of them spanning long periods of time, some of them very, very contemporary, addressing issues of COVID, mutual aid, community organizing. And there's so much to learn here about ways that questions of access, harm, relations may overlap with crip space time as it occurs in academia, but then may also be completely different. Academia is a particular kind of place, and it's typically a white-centric place. It's typically a pretty privileged space. So when we're thinking about mutual aid, community organizing, and access not in academia, I really want to pay attention to ways that non-institutional and community-oriented approaches to access are also going on and are vibrant and dynamic and have their own relations and their own questions to address that must receive attention and must receive support. And along the same lines, I would strongly recommend the collection Beyond Survival, Strategies and Stories from the Transformative Justice Movement. This was edited by Iaris Dixon and the same person I mentioned before, Leah Lakshmi Pyepsna Samara Sinha. And it's a collection of essays, works, and manifestos from the transformative justice movement. Transformative justice is a community-based way of solving problems and getting things done that does not rely upon policing structures or state laws. And again, when I'm sort of mired in questions of academia and how policies and institutions shape access, it's so valuable for me to think about movements like transformative justice that just take a radically different approach.
Yeah, awesome. And thank you for highlighting that distinction between, you know, disability studies and disability rights frameworks and disability justice, as it's more of a activist and community organizing way of producing knowledge. I appreciate the thoughtfulness there. But yeah, so this pretty much wraps up our conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today and for talking about this great new book. I've really appreciated getting to hear more about it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just been a joy to talk to you. And also, I think you're the first person I had not met, like, who I didn't already know who read the book all the way through.
Oh, really?
So this awesome. Is so exciting for me. Yeah, like, not my editor, not my buddy, you know, yay. Mm-hmm. This was my first talk with a real reader. So thank you.
Oh, awesome. That's a pleasure to hear. So thank you. 10 out of 10 would recommend. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Clayton. I really enjoyed this.